Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I'm with Jeff. How are you doing today?
Great. Glad to be here.
Perfect. So you've been pretty recently on our last podcast, so I think we can kind of skip the introduction here and kind of dive into the topic of anoxic brain injury, which sounds really sexy. So if you wouldn't mind just starting off, like what exactly is an anoxic brain injury?
Well, it's an injury caused by a lack of sufficient amount of oxygen to the brain for whatever cause, whether it's you're in an oxygen deficient environment or you're not sending oxygen to the brain with adequate blood volume, or there's not enough blood cells, or worst case scenario would be like a toxicologic cause, like a cyanide poisoning or something like that, can also deprive the brain of oxygen. So just like other cells in the body, the brain needs oxygen to work. And when it doesn't, it gets injured. And then when it stays injured for a long enough time, it actually induces cell death. And then bad things happen from there.
Yep. None of that's good. So, obviously there's a spectrum to badness, right? But like in your experience, either trauma or clinical, how rapidly is this? Can this progress?
You know, it's tough to say because if you give a little too much opioids and the person drops their sats into the high 80s, mid 80s and stuff like that, you have caused hypoxia. But you give them some naloxone, you reposition their airway, you give them actual oxygen, and they come right back and there's no detectable injury. Sometimes you do the same thing and their sats drop to 60 and they come out of it and there's evidence of anoxic brain injury. And so it's not a, like a pregnancy test kind of like it's blue or it's not blue kind of thing. There's kind of a spectrum and there are so many brain cells out there that often the brain can accommodate for the loss of a few cells here and there. But it's once it hits some, critical mass, then we're detecting, we're detecting it either on like really specific finite testing down the road, or they aren't waking up. They're having evidence of a stroke. And so it can be from completely unnoticed to they die from this. And it's just a matter of the, extent of the injury. And sometimes only time will tell.
Okay. Do people, let's say, like you mentioned, you give somebody a little bit too much opioids, their sats drop to the 60s. You panic, right? You give them the Narcan, you put a bunch of oxygen on. When they finally are kind of waking up, Steve isn't quite Steve. There's some kind of evidence. Is this something that's going to heal over time, or is this once it's happened, it's happened and that's it?
So with brain injuries, from whatever the cause, whether it's stroke, trauma, infection, anoxia, time will tell. And some people need days, weeks, months, and sometimes even years of therapy, whether it's speech, PT, OT, neurocognitive. There's all different flavors of therapies. People can make recoveries. They can work just like an injury to an arm or a leg. You can work the surrounding muscles to accommodate for the loss of a certain part of that function. So I don't want to basically tell everyone that all hope is lost. It can be a very prolonged process, and sometimes you just need to kind of just keep working at it and keep waiting. We see this a lot in the cardiac arrest realm, where someone has a cardiac arrest, very low flow state, lots of hypoxia, and they take weeks to wake up, and then they can recover to the point of walking out of the hospital, but it's not an instantaneous process at times.
Yeah, of course. So I think probably one of the more important part is like, how do I prevent it? Like, I don't have, the giant D cylinders of oxygen. I don't have wall oxygen. So when I'm already dealing with a very limited resource kind of situation, how can I best prevent this from happening? Like, is it, preparing my gear? Like, their training that I need? Like, I guess, how do I prevent it?
I think in the tactical and austere environment, the March algorithm still works for anoxic brain injury. So the first thing being keep the blood in the body so that it can carry blood up to the brain. With no blood, then anything else you do after that, if there's no blood to move the oxygen, whatever oxygen you put in, whether it's 1 liter or 1,000 liters, the brain isn't receiving any of that. So that would be first, you know, so just follow the March algorithm and keep the blood in, keep the airway patent so that whatever air, whether it's 21% room air or it's 100% oxygen, that's getting into the lungs, keeping the lungs inflated with, decreasing tension pneumothorax and then covering up holes in chest. And so the March algorithm really works. The hypothermia one's kind of interesting because we actually do change patients' brain or the body temperature to cool the brain down. I don't know that that's we're ready for that to be a field intervention yet, but certainly in the hospital, we do a lot of this in the ICUs, and the literature has kind of started to back off the exact temperature of hypothermia, and now it's really just prevent hyperthermia and fever and just kind of keep the normal temperature. But there are some patients that benefit from having their brain and body cool down to so hypothermia we're not really sure, but I think in the field for now, just keep them warm so that they don't bleed out faster from coagulation or coagulopathy from hypothermia. It would be my best recommendation. And then as far as gear goes, you know, give whatever oxygen you can give. And we can, you know, talk about positioning of the head and compared to the heart to promote venous drainage later.
Sure. So kind of, I guess, getting into that now, we've already mentioned being able to give oxygen, some other interventions. One thing I've definitely noticed is when it comes to monitoring, to even know that this is happening, the March algorithm, it's a little bit late when it's so small, just throw it on their finger. And hopefully, at least if they're perfusing that finger, you'll at least be aware of these things that are happening, you know?
Yeah, we have a big amount of research that came out of the University of Arizona and the state of Arizona for civilian traumatic brain injury patients over a few years, where they did kind of a pre-post study where they took a whole bunch of patients transported to Arizona trauma centers, and they looked to see what happened in the field and what happened in the hospital. And then they did training for all EMS providers to keep the saturations above 90%, to keep the blood pressure above 90 millimeters of mercury, the systolic, and then keep their end-tidal CO2 between 35 and 45 if they were on a BVM or ventilator. And then they trained everyone, did a washout period, like waited till everyone was trained and whatnot. And then they studied another group of people, and they had about 15,000 people beforehand and about 6,000 people afterwards. And they showed that giving high flow oxygen to all patients, giving fluids if they were hypotensive or to prevent hypotension, and really preventing someone bagging too fast and just keeping the end tidal between 35 and 45, they found that the mortality went up 2 to 3-fold individually for hypotension and hypoxia, and about 5 to 6-fold, a kind of a cumulative, for combined hypotension and hypoxia. And so it's not a randomized trial. We didn't randomize people to get hypoxic. We just said if they got hypoxic despite this intervention, their mortality was 2 to 3 times as high, you know, 2 to 3 times higher than if we never let them get hypoxic. And that level of hypoxia was 90%. They have since done more analysis of this and found that the actual harm or the real harm starts at minimum 96-97%. And really, if they exclude out a bunch of other confounders, that anything less than 100% increases your chance of mortality. And it might be 4% higher mortality from 100 to 99, but certainly letting it go down to 90, your mortality starts creeping up a significant amount. And so our goal in the field, based on the best available evidence, should be keep the SATs at 100% in the field resuscitation phase with whatever amount of oxygen you can give. If you can only give 1 liter a minute, that's all, that's better than nothing. But the goal really should be 100 whenever you can. And so that's maintaining an airway, maintaining ventilation, and maintaining perfusion.
So speaking of maintaining your airway, you know, when you're, especially if you're using just like a little Nonin, okay, you know, all those numbers are essentially in the past, right? Because of lag time and blood flow and et cetera, et cetera. So the sicker somebody is, the difference between their SpO2 and their PaO2 gets farther and farther apart, the sicker they get, right? So when it comes to that airway decision, like if their face is mangled and they can't breathe, that's a pretty slam dunk situation. You don't really have to think that hard about it. But when you're talking about ventilatory problems, low hypoxia, hypercarbia, etc., you actually need to make a decision. You need to make it fairly quickly about that. So when in your practice, kind of what is your trigger? What is like that kind of line in the sand as far as his sats drop below this number, I am going to take his airway?
Yeah, in the field, I would say the simplest, using the simplest airway is the best one, meaning that if all that's needed is repositioning and mm-hmm. that gets you what you need, great. And if it's, you know, and then start escalating from there. If you then you have to balance, okay, what am I really good at? Am I really good at surgical airways, or am I really good at supraglottic airways, or am I really good at oral tracheal intubation? Because what we don't want to have happen is you pick the gold standard airway, which let's say is oral tracheal intubation, mm-hmm. but you have never done that before. That opens the patient up to a whole host of bad outcomes, whether it's hypoxia, airway complications, you know, bradycardia, increased intracranial pressures. So we would actually say intubation is not the right thing for this patient in either supraglottic airway or going straight to front of neck airway access. For conversely, if you are only trained and proficient at surgical airways, it may be better for the patient to just have that be the ideal airway. So I have to kind of say it depends. For mm-hmm. me as a civilian EMS physician, I would say generally it's going to be at minimum and a supraglottic airway. And depending on my resources and my time to the hospital, I will probably go with oral tracheal intubation in as safe of a manner as possible. You know, if it's certainly in a tactical environment, getting the quickest airway possible usually trumps the safer, more time delayed, you know, where a good RSI probably takes 5 or so minutes. And mm-hmm. sometimes that's doable. And sometimes you don't have those 5 minutes and you have to say, in light of other more pressing issues, I'm going to take the simpler, faster, more successful airway and go with, you know, sedation, paralysis, and an eye gel placement. And that may be because I'm confident that the eye gel will successfully allow oxygenation and ventilation. But if it's a, you know, like a penetrating trauma to the neck where I suspect that the airway is going to close, then not having plastic either through the cords or below the cords will be detrimental to the patient. So you have to kind of look at the airway and you have to look at what you think the airway is going to look like if you were to stick a blade in the mouth and say, mm-hmm. okay, this needs something stenting open the airway or going, you know, this is a failed approach and we're going to go yep. through the neck.
Definitely. And I think kind of regardless of what a technique, whether you're doing your supraglottics or your subglottic airways, like you have to have a trigger point of yeah. like his sats have gone, yeah. they are now 95. They are now, it went to, my trigger is like 95. It just went from 95 to 94. Okay.
I would now say we're doing it. In light of, like in the past, we probably would have said anything like at or below 90. The hard part is now with this new data that came out that was presented about a year ago this month, it really brings to light, well, if they're not maintaining 100%, you know, through non-invasive face mask ventilation, oxygenation, do we need to progress up to a positive pressure ventilation? And we don't really have a good answer for that. I'd say personally, I'm uncomfortable if they're maintaining SATs below 94%, you know, despite 15 or even double, like, you know, because we're blessed in the civilian environment of having all the detanks that you mentioned you don't have access to. I can put a 15 liter per minute nasal cannula on under a face mask at 15 to 25 liters. And now I'm flowing 30 to 55 liters. Or, you know, that's kind of a, or 30, 50 liters. I would say that if that's failing, then it's probably time to switch to 100% oxygen via the, via an endotracheal or a supraglottic airway, if they are not getting above 94%.
Okay.
Obviously, figure out, like, do they just have a massive pneumothorax that's compressing the lung? So right. Rule out your other, you know, correctable causes. But if it's truly just lack of response to face mask and nasal cannula oxygen, then I think you have to assume that more like 100% oxygen, because they can still entrain room air and dilute out that. When you see them sucking those, like, just like gulping in air, they can pull that inspiratory flow rate can be faster than the 50 liters you're flowing into them. And so now 21% is kind of diluting down that 100%. Who knows where you're going to end up? And that's why they may not be getting to, you know, higher above 94%. But I think I'd probably say if they're consistent below 94%, that's probably my trigger to say, okay, what we're doing is not working and we need to escalate from here.
Right. Perfect. So, you know, despite all our best efforts, I suspect either once I finally got monitoring on, his SATs were below, you know, let's say they're below 80, like this was not good, or I've been unable so far to get it up any higher. I've taken the airway. I found new oxygen, right, to put on the patient. But I suspect that he now has an anoxic brain injury due to, you know, patient response going forward. Like your sedation meds are lasting a lot longer than what I would expect, type of thing. Or neuro is different, or whatever it is. But I suspect things have changed. How do I go about treating this? Do I just kind of carte blanche, this is a brain injury patient, and break out the hypertonics or what?
Yeah, this is definitely out of the realm of most of emergency medicine, and dipping definitely into the neurocritical care world. What I have seen is that anoxic brain injury, where it's just a pure lack of oxygen that caused the what you just described, generally doesn't have herniation early on. And so shrinking the size of the brain may not get you a big improvement in your situation. Now, certainly dead brain from hypoxia can cause swelling and herniation eventually, but in the first hour or two, they may not be herniating yet. And so it's certainly a possibility. Certainly got to look for, you know, blown pupils, the vital sign abnormalities, if they are breathing on their own, looking for, you know, Chain Stokes breathing or, you know, Biots or something like that. In an ultrasound, if you see increased intracranial pressure on your optic nerve sheath diameter, then that definitely worries you that there is increased intracranial pressure, maybe from and causing herniation. But I would say early on, it's really preventing it and then preventing it from happening in the first place, and then preventing a secondary brain injury, like letting them get hypoxic again. And so whatever you can do, obviously first, don't get a brain injury in the first place. But then after that, it's all about preventing secondary and tertiary brain injuries, because you forgot to put a peat valve on. You forgot to turn the oxygen on. You over sedated someone who was spontaneously breathing through a surgical airway. And they didn't breathe well enough. So it's really just preventing secondary harm or tertiary harm.
Yeah. With anything, there are things that you can't let happen. with a particular injury. And with the TBI, as I understand it, it's you cannot let them become hypoxic. In this case, would be secondary injury. You cannot let them become hypotensive as well, like you had mentioned before. Other than him, continuing to bleed in resuscitation, like, are there any other reasons why they would just become hypoxic or not hypoxic? I'm sorry, hypotensive.
Spinal cord injury. If you have hypotension, you have to think, what are my causes of shock? So it's just, it's the four categories. So it's hypovolemic, whether it's blood loss or just like plasma or insensible losses. Cardiogenic, is there something, causing the heart not to beat? Is it hypocalcemia, hyperkalemia from injury or blood transfusion stuff? Is it distributive? Do you have poor tone because they're bleeding out and now they're vasoplegic? Rarely you can get an anaphylactic reaction to meds or blood transfusion products. I'm drawing a blank on the last one. Obstructive shock. So mm-hmm. PE, fat embolism, tension pneumo. Tension. Yeah. And so, or in cardiac tamponade. And so you can try to rule those out with physical exam, ultrasound, but you're often limited in the austere environment or the field environment to know what you're really dealing with. So you have to kind of give what you have. If you think it's hypovolemic, giving fluids, whether it's blood products or crystalloids, if you don't think it's blood loss. If you think it's anaphylaxis or anaphylactoid, then epinephrine. If you think that certainly tension pneumo or pericardial tamponade, then sticking a needle somewhere, preferably after you've confirmed with some kind of imaging, may be helpful. And then, field treatment of a fat embolism or a pulmonary embolism is, pretty much nil. And then distributive shock from a spinal cord injury, I think you would, start a vasopressor infusion. You can certainly try positioning, but I don't know how much bang for your buck you're going to get in that aspect. So it's really just trying to prevent the hypoxia or the hypotension from the common cause. And then if it's toxicologic from cyanide, there is the cyanokit hydroxycobalamin treatment. I don't know how often that's available, but that would be the plan. If you pulled someone out of a burning vehicle and they were hypotensive, that would be the indication to give empiric hydroxycobalamin.
I don't generally see that as far as line units, but there's definitely specialty units that they have that stuff for days. What are my target goals when it comes to resuscitation? Because especially if you're talking epinephrine, I can make it as high as I want,
I think certainly we have the brain injury papers that say bare minimum 90, but the sweet spot of mortality seems to be in like the 120 to 140 systolic range. And then sometimes they'll switch systolic for MAP and probably MAP 65 to 85 in that range. But at least 90 or higher for a systolic. And obviously there's some number on the top end that experts will debate, nothing over 140, nothing over 160, 180 is probably too high. But the sweet spot for least chance of death is kind of in that 120 to 140 range. And then anything outside of that, it's a U-shaped curve. And so anything on either end tends to have higher chance of mortality. End-tidal CO2 or PaCO2 between 35, 45. So having whoever you've assigned to the BVM, telling them they have to watch your EMA or whatever device you're using to record end-tidal CO2 values. Or if you've got them on a ventilator, titrating your minute volume to end-tidal or to a PCO2 if you're lucky enough to do a blood gas. And then, like we talked about, keeping the SATs at bare minimum 90, but more likely in 96 to 100 would be great. And you hit on it that the pulse ox is just saturation of the of saturation of the oxygen or of the hemoglobin molecules, but it does not tell you what the actual PaO2 is because of like the shifting of the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curves based on, you know, temperature and acidosis and all these other conditions. And so, you know, a SAT of 90 could be a PaO2 of 30 or could be 300, you know, and obviously that's over exaggerated, but you don't really know where you are on the PaO2 level until you actually draw a gas from an artery. Unfortunately, we can't really rely on venous PaO2s because the body just extracts so much oxygen. By the time it gets to the venous side, the CO2 is good until they're super hypotensive, but the PaO2 just isn't good enough. So if you have the ability to do an arterial stick and actually run a point of care blood gas, that can let you dial in your gas a little bit better. But in the non-invasive, resource limited field environment, you do need to have your SAT of, you know, as close to 100, because once you have a SAT of 100, you've achieved that kind of plateau phase where the PaO2 might be 100 or it might be 1,000. And the only difference is that the more oxygen you have, the more on that flat part you are, so that if you do run out of oxygen, you're not falling off the curve as fast. You've moved away from the cliff by, you know, feet to yards to miles, depending on how much oxygen you have. And there's even research going on right now of hyperbaric oxygen, where we're sending people to 2 to 3 atmospheres of oxygen, or 2 or 3 atmospheres with 100% oxygen to increase their PaO2 to, you know, like orders of magnitude higher, and seeing if that affects, because we're just bombarding the brain with oxygen in that hypoxic state. So more to come on that. We're eager to see if that improves morbidity and mortality.
Right. When it comes to either preventing or treating an anoxic brain injury, do you have any advice on for the younger medics? Not me, of course.
The big thing is treating secondary problems, or you're kind of preventing problems from occurring. So we already talked about your blood pressure and your oxygen level, but the other things would be like treating pain, treating agitation. Like those pain and agitation cause increased intracranial pressure, which can induce extra injury. They can also burn up oxygen if you're fighting around a lot and you're on an oxygen or limited oxygen supply. You may have a higher oxygen utilization rate that prevents your brain from getting oxygen because now your muscles are needing it. So treating, you know, adequately treating pain, sedating anyone who is overly agitated. We are definitely starting to be more aggressive with seizure prophylaxis and seizure management. So trying to prevent seizures from happening, and if they are happening, certainly being aggressive with treating them. Which your sedatives, depending on which ones you give, may do both, like a midazolam and more to come on the ketamine, which, you know, we've talked about in the past, but, ketamine, has the potential to be a dual effect medication in this realm. Preventing hypoglycemia, which is possible. That's also a brain injury in and of itself. And so just maintaining a normal blood sugar. We used to be very tight on blood pressure or blood sugar control. I think we've started to widen the gap just because we saw that being too narrow caused too many hypoglycemia episodes, and that injured brains as well. The temperature, more to come on what the right temperature is, but we think at the very least, avoid a fever. And so oral, IV, or even rectal Tylenol can help, you know, removing warm clothing, the bear hugger, or the active warming and passive warming devices if it's no longer needed. And then, you know, I would say in your environment, definitely reaching out to an intensivist, particularly a neurocritical care intensivist, to determine fluid management for, what's the ideal sodium level, because the amount of sodium in the bloodstream can affect the size of the blood cells long term. And sometimes we want to have a higher sodium concentration so that we can pull fluid out and pull that edema out of the brain so that they don't get worsening brain injury.
Yep. Makes sense. Well, very good. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely something that we see a lot of. In the past, we kind of just threw our hands up and said, oh, there's nothing we can do, until someone looked at it and said, wait a minute, actually the basic stuff matters. Everyone can attack this problem to the best of their ability. And even the non-medical provider can prevent hypotension through blood loss, roll them on their side for an airway, keep their airway open if they're, put hands on holes in chest and stuff to prevent the lungs from going down and stuff. So it's not just a doctor, medic, nurse, or PA, level event. This is from the basics. Once again, the basics save more lives than the advanced stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The basics matter.
Yeah.
Well, very good. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Love to come back anytime. Let me know.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Our boy is waiting there for you.